Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. The king was dead. The first rays of the morning sun shone over the dry ridge to the east, illuminating a shattered landscape. The king hadn't died alone. Corpses littered the battlefield, scattered among broken spears, discarded axes, spent arrows, and shattered javelins. His subjects in life had followed him into death. A small group of those subjects, still living, unlike their erstwhile comrades and their king, picked their way through the ruins of the previous day's fighting. One of them limped, using a spear shaft to support his weight. Another stopped to retie the bloody bandage wrapped around a gash in his arm. It was quiet now, but they remembered the clash of bronze on bronze, cracking shields, the meaty thud of weapons into flesh, and the cries of injured men and beasts. The memories of those sounds haunted the dry basin near the Nile, ghosts winding their way around the restless souls of the newly dead. They found the king at the center of the battlefield. Sekenenre Tau was lying on his left side, his hands bound behind his back. One quick glance at what remained of his face left the men wishing they hadn't looked. The king was dead, and he, like the other bodies scattered around him, was starting to stink. Death made no exceptions for kings only a step removed from the divine. The survivors would make sure their army's dead received the proper treatment, enough to ensure that their souls would find their way to the afterlife in due time. They were Egyptians, and the correct steps had to be followed. Hoisting the king's corpse up off the ground, the men carefully hefted the decomposing body back toward their camp, where it would begin its last journey. To the south, to the capital city of Thebes, where Sekenenre Tau's mummy would reside in its final resting place for all eternity. The king had failed to defeat his rival, but his sons would carry on the fight. They too would be kings, and other kings would follow them, from then until the end of time, just as kings had preceded them back to the beginning of time. Sekenenre Tau's dynasty was the 17th to rule Egypt, as they counted these things. Now that was an ambitious claim. Really, he ruled the city of Thebes, and other kings ruled elsewhere. Egypt's Middle Kingdom, its second golden age, had ended a century before. The country was fragmented and disunited. Chaos ruled, and it was the king's duty to reunite Egypt, to restore the two lands to the rule of a single man, to ensure the return of order. Only then would things once again be right in the black land of the Nile. Also, I have some really cool news. I wrote a book. It's called The Verge: Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. If you enjoyed our seasons of Tides of History on the early modern period, then I promise you'll like this. The Verge is out now, and you can order a hard copy, ebook, or audiobook, which I read, naturally, from your distributor of choice. If you've ever been looking for a way to support Tides of History, ordering The Verge is the best way you could do that. I'd really appreciate it. There's a link in this episode description that will take you there. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. The timescales involved in ancient Egypt are just mind-boggling. The first pharaoh of the Old Kingdom, the era that produced the most famous pyramids we know today, was roughly as far removed from the first pharaoh of the early dynastic period as we are from Martin Luther and the beginning of the Protestant Reformation. The end of the Old Kingdom was as distant in time from its beginning as Martin Luther was from the Norman conquest of England. And all of this, of course, happened a very, very long time ago. The Old Kingdom ended around 2100 BC. There were still woolly mammoths alive on Wrangel Island in the Arctic when the first classical age of Egyptian history came to an end. These vast stretches of time can make ancient Egypt seem eternal and unchanging. There were always pharaohs who ruled from a position closer to the gods than their subjects. The monuments they built towered over the landscape for millennia. Their beautiful, impossibly detailed hieroglyphic writing, once inscribed, remained in place, carrying its messages forever. Yet this impression is wrong. Pharaohs and their dynasties rose and fell. The power of the pharaoh's government waxed and waned. Sometimes it exerted direct control over the lives of countless Egyptians. Other times, the kings barely controlled anything outside the walls of their own palaces. Egyptian control over neighboring regions came and went, and so did their interest in the outside world. Artistic and literary conventions shifted. Beliefs in the gods and the afterlife changed over time. Even the seemingly unalterable Nile floods, the lifeblood of Egypt's agricultural bounty, were higher or lower from year to year, decade to decade, and century to century. Nothing lasted forever. And the Egyptians knew this. They had a sophisticated sense of their own history, even if their conception of time and causality, why things happened, was much different from ours. Kings looked to past rulers' monuments for inspiration when they built their own. They remembered their predecessors. They kept lists of them. They gave offerings at their temples and their statues. Some periods, the Egyptians knew, were better than others. The Old Kingdom was the first of these, the foundational period to which later Egyptians looked for reminders of their past glories, for their sense of what it meant to be Egyptian. But there were also two more of these classical periods. The New Kingdom, home to pharaohs like Ramesses the Great and Tutankhamun, and the impossibly rich tombs of the Valley of the Kings. The New Kingdom was a victim of the Bronze Age collapse. And before that, there was the Middle Kingdom. Now, this is a period that's less familiar today, but it's still fundamental for Egyptian history and for the Egyptians' understanding of that history. The Middle Kingdom is what we'll discuss today, but not in isolation from the periods on either side of it, what scholars call the First and Second Intermediate Periods. There's a tendency to marginalize these intermediate periods in our discussions of ancient Egypt. After all, there are the times when all-powerful pharaohs, the defining features of ancient Egypt, weren't actually all-powerful or in control of the whole country. That makes these intermediate periods kind of hard to fit into any straightforward story of ancient Egyptian history, except as brief interludes, soon forgotten. I think that's a mistake. Periods of profound and prolonged disunity are just as much a feature of ancient Egypt as those periods of unified and centralized rule. Even within those periods of unified rule, what we know as the Old, Middle, and New Kingdoms, not all pharaohs were equally powerful, and their rules weren't all equally centralized. The intermediate periods, rather than standing outside the normal course of ancient Egyptian history, are actually just the most outstanding representations of the constant tendency toward fragmentation and disunity. Every pharaoh had to fight Egypt's tendency to break apart. Some of them were simply more successful than others. We shouldn't take Egypt's fundamental unity for granted or treat it like some baseline given. The ancient Egyptians themselves absolutely did not take it for granted. They knew that order and harmony, what they called Ma'at and personified in a goddess, also called Ma'at, had an opposite, Isfet, meaning chaos and disharmony. Ma'at couldn't exist without Isfet, no order without chaos. No unified Egypt governed in accordance with divine will without a fragmented, disharmonious, and poorly run Egypt to serve as its counterpart. The Egyptians celebrated the classical golden ages like the Middle Kingdom precisely because they knew and feared the alternative. The Old Kingdom, as I mentioned earlier, lasted for a long time, about five centuries, give or take, coming to an end sometime around the middle of the 22nd century BC, 2150 BC or so, give or take. Scholars argue about the absolute dates and precisely which dynasty, the 6th, the 7th, or the 8th, actually marked the end of the Old Kingdom. In the grand scheme of things, it's not really that important. What is important is how we understand that end and what replaced it. That's the essence of the First Intermediate Period. So, what happened? On the one hand, we might understand the end of the Old Kingdom as a full-on social collapse. That's often how it's been portrayed. The sparse written sources from the period do mention extremely low Nile floods and famine, but the archaeological record doesn't point to anything like a full-blown disintegration of Egyptian society. For a lot of people, probably most of them, very little actually changed. Rather than a full social collapse, the end of the Old Kingdom was really just the end of centralized governance. There were still kings. In fact, there was more than one king, and that was precisely the problem. These multiple kings ruled different parts of what had formerly been a unified Egypt, and each of them lacked the essentially unquestioned authority of their predecessors. Far more power resided in the hands of local officials. At the most extreme periods of fragmentation during the First Intermediate, each of the 22 rulers of the nomes, the administrative provinces of Egypt, could be his own little king. The creation of Egypt was a political act. It was an act embodied in the figure of the pharaoh. No pharaoh, no Egypt, basically. So what was Egypt if there were two or more pharaohs? Or a whole bunch of petty local officials claiming power and authority in their local region? If the nomarch, the ruler of a nome, based in Thebes in Upper Egypt, said he was king, and the nomarch based in Heracleopolis, way to the north near the Fayum Oasis, said he didn't answer to that guy, and nobody in the Nile Delta answered to either one, then what was Egypt, really? That's what the First Intermediate Period actually was. The disappearance of an agreed-upon centralized authority ruling, legitimately, the entirety of Egypt. But this wasn't an overnight thing, and we shouldn't view it as a binary, where you have either all-powerful centralized royal authority capable of building pyramids and whatnot, or a profusion of independent local officials ruling their little stretches of the Nile without interference from anybody else. Even within the Old Kingdom, royal power waxed and waned over time. Power was extremely centralized during the Fourth Dynasty, which was when pharaohs like Khufu and Khafre built their really stunning and enormous pyramids at Giza. Power was much less centralized during the Sixth Dynasty, which immediately preceded the First Intermediate Period. During the Sixth Dynasty, pharaohs routinely married some of their many daughters to powerful local officials to ensure their loyalty. These same local officials built really impressive tombs for themselves. They often imitated the royal style of decoration. They essentially became dynasties unto themselves, with fathers passing their administrative posts on to their sons. The pharaohs of the later Old Kingdom, far from being all-powerful, had to find ways of ruling in cooperation with a much broader and more localized elite class than their predecessors. So at the end of the Sixth Dynasty, a pharaoh named Pepi II ruled for a very, very long time. At least 60 years, maybe even longer than that. As long as Pepi II was alive, pretty much everybody could agree that even if he wasn't actually exercising much power, the local officials were the ones doing that, he was still the unquestioned king. But when Pepi II died, leaving behind a great many potential heirs, he had been busy over the course of that 60 years, centralized rule fell apart almost immediately. We don't know exactly how this happened, but it seems likely that the different nomarchs, those local officials, backed different sons as potential claimants to the throne. No ruler after Pepi II had that same unquestioned legitimacy. And thus the Old Kingdom came to an end and the First Intermediate began, sliding down that spectrum from centralized rule to local power. We're so used to taking the state and the king ruling it as our point of reference that we treat any sort of disruption to that as an unmitigated disaster. After all, highly centralized rule is what tends to produce lavish art and architecture, monumental buildings, and the kinds of records, both physical and written, that last for millennia. But was centralized rule actually good for people? And if so, then for which people exactly? It's worth thinking about these kinds of things. Peasants who no longer had to go and haul gigantic slabs of limestone for a pharaoh's pyramid every few years might not have been too bothered by a less active centralized government. The profusion of local power centers throughout Egypt in the First Intermediate produced a flowering of local and regional cultures, artistic styles, beautiful tomb complexes all over the place. This was a less strictly hierarchical society than that of the Old Kingdom. There were more opportunities for an ambitious person to find a patron. There were more focal points for art, literature, and commerce, rather than everything being directed upward toward the king. Men were more likely to be buried with weapons. They were armed retainers surrounding their local ruler in death and presumably in life, too. But that doesn't necessarily mean society was actually more violent. This was a different society, but not necessarily a worse one. We're not exactly certain about how long the First Intermediate Period lasted. Probably around a century, but it could have been more, could have been less. What's clear is that the extreme fragmentation early in the First Intermediate gave way to consolidation. Some of those local rulers emerged as much more powerful than their rivals. Their claims to being king were worthwhile enough to be taken seriously. After a little while, two of these dynasties stood out from their peers. One of them was based at Heracleopolis in Middle Egypt, just south of the Fayum Oasis. The other was at Thebes in Upper Egypt. The line of kings based at Heracleopolis made up what Egyptologists call the 9th and the 10th dynasties. The Theban kings, who were ruling at the same time, were the 11th dynasty. Eventually, the Theban kings of the 11th dynasty vanquished their rivals at Heracleopolis, they extended their rule over all of Egypt, and they became the first rulers of the period we call the Middle Kingdom. To be clear, we have no idea exactly how this happened, or even what reunification means in the context of the first intermediate period. We know that the Theban kings did a bit of fighting against their rivals, but how much we should view their march to victory as a military one is kind of obscure. The most likely explanation for their eventual takeover of Egypt involves some outright conquest, some deal-making with the powerful local rulers we talked about, and probably some backstabbing and politicking too. We know that the Theban kings did their very best to eradicate the power of the nomarchs, those local rulers, once and for all as soon as they'd established themselves. Before that, though, they probably needed the nomarchs and their local authority and connections. The Old Kingdom ended with a slide along the spectrum from centralized rule to local fragmentation. The Middle Kingdom began with a slide in the opposite direction, from local fragmentation to centralized rule. In either case, we shouldn't assume this happened overnight. Instead, probably they were more like slow, gradual, structural processes punctuated by the occasional dramatic event like a battle. It's unfortunate that we don't know about much of the latter to give this story a bit more oomph, but the sources simply don't permit us to say much beyond the barest outline. Nearly 40 years into a reign that would eventually last for more than 50 years, a Theban king named Mentuhotep II succeeded in reunifying Egypt. The Middle Kingdom began to take shape.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know, with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you-know-business.
Mentuhotep II was the sixth ruler of the 11th dynasty. He inherited a strong, localized kingdom in Thebes from his father, a guy named Intef III, and ruled it long and well for almost four decades before finally achieving what he had set out to do. In the 39th year of his reign, Mentuhotep II took the royal name Shematawi, meaning he who unifies the two lands. This was a label that harkened back to Egypt's long history of centralized rule, a tradition that began with Narmer's unification of the two lands more than 1,000 years before. That tradition extended through the early dynastic period to the pharaohs of the Old Kingdom, the pyramid builders who left their mark on the Egyptian landscape for all time to come, and then into the mists of the First Intermediate. With Mentuhotep's victory, those mists parted, and a second classical age of Egyptian history began. The Middle Kingdom was not a simple replay of the Old Kingdom, some sort of slavish imitation of past glories. Times had changed. The easy self-confidence of the Old Kingdom never really returned. Throughout the whole Middle Kingdom, and well beyond it, we can detect a distinct fear of chaotic forces in a whole variety of ancient Egyptian media. Disorder, disunity, disharmony, these were things that Egyptians increasingly worried about and strove to master. To the extent that the first intermediate period really marked some kind of collapse or disaster, this was the most profound sense in which it was true. Something got stuck in the collective psyche of Egyptians during this age of fragmentation, and it remained there for millennia afterward. When they looked back at the Old Kingdom, which they did constantly, Egyptians of the Middle Kingdom were hearkening back to an age without this nagging sense of fear about the possibility of a descent into chaos. It's easy to mistake this constant looking backward at the glories of bygone ages with a kind of dull archaism, like Egyptians of every subsequent period were somehow trying to imitate or copy a better past. That's not really the case. As the Egyptologist Adela Oppenheim points out, there's a big difference between archaism and continuity. The Egyptians did retain distinctive artistic forms and norms for hundreds or even thousands of years, to the point where they're instantly recognizable even today. They also knew and respected their past, and they kept a kind of a retrospective framework for understanding their place in the world. But they also innovated. They weren't just reinventing the same cultural forms with tiny changes for thousands of years. As much as the people of the Middle Kingdom, from pharaohs to artists, might have imitated their predecessors, they also tried new things, and even the practices they retained or copied were put to new uses in different contexts. Take Mentuhotep II, the founder of the Middle Kingdom, as an example. Scholars today and ancient Egyptians themselves regarded Mentuhotep II as one of the founders or unifiers of the Egyptian state, like Narmer at the very dawn of history in the early dynastic period, and Ahmose II in the New Kingdom, a couple of centuries down the road from here. We've talked before about the close connections between Egyptian rulers and the divine while they were alive, and after death, it was common for past pharaohs to be worshipped as divine beings themselves. But so far as we can tell, Mentuhotep II was the only one of these great rulers to be deified while he was still alive. Whether he claimed that divine status as a means of legitimizing himself as sole ruler prior to the final unification of Egypt, or afterward as a sign of his triumph, is hard to say. But either way, if claiming divine status while still alive is not an innovation, I don't know what is. After more than 1,000 years of unified rulership and traditions, Mentuhotep II did something very, very different and distinct at the beginning of the Middle Kingdom. So prior to finishing off his last rivals, Mentuhotep II and his predecessors of the 11th dynasty had ruled from the city of Thebes in Upper Egypt. Why did Thebes turn out to be such a strong base for Egypt's new rulers? In part because of its favorable geographical position. Thebes sat at the intersection of the most important desert trade routes and the Nile Valley in Upper Egypt, the southern, narrower part of the Nile Valley. Gemstones, copper, specialized stone for building, gold from Nubia and more distant lands, all of these things were easily accessed from Thebes, and the city also benefited from easy communication and transport up and down river. Moreover, this was the region of Egypt with the longest tradition of centralized state control. That's probably because the Upper Nile heartland was the part of Egypt that was easiest to control. The Nile Valley was narrow, with only a little strip of valuable floodplain on either side of the river into which villages, towns, and cities were densely packed. Lower, meaning northern Egypt, and especially the Nile Delta, by contrast, were open to the deserts on both sides. The Delta was a maze of shifting channels, reeds, and low-lying land. A state based there, rather than the rich but thin farmland of the Upper Nile, would be oriented much differently. We'll come back to that a little later. Reuniting Egypt was no easy task for Mentuhotep II. It wasn't as straightforward as hearkening back to a past golden age of powerful kings and glorious royal building projects like the pyramids. Times had changed, and kingship and governance needed to change as well. Mentuhotep II seems to have spent a lot of time fighting, or at least ordering people to fight on his behalf. He fought Nubians, the people living to the south of Upper Egypt in what's today Sudan. He fought the Libyans living to the west of the Nile Delta. He fought people living in the eastern desert between the Nile and the Red Sea. He probably launched a campaign into southern Palestine. And of course, he fought other Egyptians too. One of the most striking images to come out of Mentuhotep II's reign is what appears at first glance to be a standard smiting scene. The king, pictured from the side as an oversized figure, is about to bash a prisoner over the head with a mace. These images had been a staple of royal imagery going all the way back to Narmer, if not even further into Egyptian prehistory. But in this case, Mentuhotep II is depicted smiting an Egyptian, not a foreigner. Divine or not, Mentuhotep II had to bash some Egyptian heads to reunite the two lands of Upper and Lower Egypt. He also had to reorganize the kingdom's governance, which he did by building on the local administration he already had in Thebes and reintroducing a bunch of old official posts from the old kingdom, like royal scribe and vizier. Like his old kingdom predecessors, Mentuhotep II also launched a large-scale royal building program. He filled the landscape of Egypt, especially Upper Egypt, with monumental reminders of his power and role as the unifier of Egypt. His mortuary temple at Deir el-Bahri in Thebes is an absolute masterpiece of innovative construction. It was the largest building constructed in Egypt since the Old Kingdom centuries before. It was much bigger than the tombs of his predecessors in the 11th dynasty at Thebes, and it was much different than the pyramid complexes of the Old Kingdom rulers. Mentuhotep's temple had to be approached via a grand causeway more than 1,000 meters, or two-thirds of a mile long. The facade loomed up at the visitor, presented a view of porticos studded with large sandstone pillars. As the person got closer, they saw a forest of sandstone figures of Mentuhotep standing on either side of the causeway. Before entering the temple itself, a visitor had to pass through an elaborate garden planted with dozens of sycamore figs and tamarisk shrubs, all of which were watered by a sophisticated irrigation system. This garden, the only one securely known from this period, may have been intended to echo the grove of Osiris, the god of the afterlife in Egyptian myth. And that was just the beginning. The king's tomb was located deep inside the mountain behind the main chapel. The tomb was less a burial crypt than a monumental chamber with a giant alabaster statue that served as a shrine. Inside that was a wooden coffin holding the king's body. It was reminiscent of the burial of a god. Even the walls were decorated with hundreds of meters, thousands of feet, of incredibly intricate and beautiful carved images. These carvings, still bearing the bright colors with which they were painted 4,000 years ago, only exist in fragments today, but they still cover a huge number of subjects. A worker carrying a huge bundle of papyrus sheaves, Mentuhotep with the goddess Hathor, a procession of royal women, all of them depicted in exquisitely realistic detail. Mentuhotep's mortuary temple was a unique achievement. It was one that future pharaohs tried and mostly failed to emulate. Mentuhotep II ruled for a grand total of 51 years, at least a decade as the king of a unified Egypt. And his successors in the 11th dynasty stuck around at Thebes. They didn't last too long, though. Within 20 years or so, the 11th dynasty had come to an end, and the 12th dynasty rose to replace it. The 12th dynasty marked a series of major changes. Its first pharaoh, Amenemhat I, was probably a vizier for his predecessor, the last member of the 11th dynasty. Despite the fact that he reigned for a full 30 years, we don't know much about how Amenemhat I came to the throne, or even what he did for much of his time on the throne. There are some indications that he became pharaoh in troubled times. He may have had to fight and win a civil war in order to gain his office. His Horus name, one of the royal titles by which he was known, translates to "he who calms the heart of the two lands." An inscribed stone, or stela, belonging to a military commander of Amenemhat I named Nesmont gives us a bit more information. The stela reads, quote, "I led the battle for the two lands. I was victorious. I destroyed the foes. I overthrew the enemies of my lord." Clearly, Amenemhat emerged from this disorder victorious. Inscriptions bearing his name show up at temples and administrative buildings in the Nile Delta, even on inscribed statue fragments in the Sinai, where Amenemhat sent an expedition to acquire copper and turquoise. But his most impactful act was moving Egypt's capital back to the north, where it had been during the Old Kingdom. Rather than sticking around Thebes or even setting up shop at a previously occupied capital like Memphis, Amenemhat founded a brand new capital called Itshawi Amenemhat, or Amenemhat is the one who grasps the two lands, near the modern village of Lisht. Why there? We're not sure, but it's probably meaningful that Itshawi is directly on the border of Upper and Lower Egypt. It's in the very middle of the country. And aside from ruling from the north of Egypt, Amenemhat also echoed his old kingdom predecessors in another key way. He built a pyramid. It was small, somewhat hastily built, perhaps finished in the reign of his son and successor, but it was a pyramid. To ease the succession, Amenemhat ruled jointly with his son, Senusret I, for at least a decade. He set up a co-regency that left zero doubt about who would come next. Considering the fact that Amenemhat may have been assassinated or at the very least attacked in a serious plot, this was not a trivial thing. In a literary text known as The Instruction of King Amenemhat I for his son Senusret I, the king lays out some advice for his successor. Quote, "Trust not a brother, know not a friend. Make no intimates, it is worthless. When you lie down, guard your heart yourself, for no man has adherence on the day of woe." Yet despite a rocky beginning, Amenemhat I inaugurated one of the most stable and productive periods in all of ancient Egyptian history. Just eight kings ruled for more than 200 years over the course of the 12th dynasty, smoothly handing power from one generation to the next. Great works of art, architecture, and especially literature define this golden age. Religious and philosophical questioning, artistic innovations, shifts in the appearance and meaning of kingship, all of these things took place under the watchful eye of a series of powerful, long-lived kings. That's not to say that the Middle Kingdom was static and unchanging over the long period of stability, nor does stability mean that things were uneventful. The historical sources, the kinds we would use to reconstruct a narrative story about what happened in the 12th dynasty, are pretty patchy. But we do get a sense for internal unrest, powerful old families that resented the power of the central government and its ruling dynasty, things like that. And somewhere around the middle of the 12th dynasty, rather suddenly, almost simultaneously, and for reasons that are almost totally unclear, there was a major shift in a whole bunch of different aspects of life and politics in Egypt. During the reign of a king named Senusret III, which was maybe the high point of the 12th dynasty and the Middle Kingdom as a whole, Egypt passed some kind of turning point. Instead of a widespread royal presence throughout Egypt, with temple dedications and statues of the king marking the landscape everywhere from the Nile Delta to Nubia, the kingdom grew much more centralized. It was focused on just a few sites. The elite buried themselves with royal insignia. They identified themselves with the god Osiris in ways they previously hadn't. But at the same time, the independent provincial tombs of powerful governors and local families disappeared. Basically, if you wanted to be a powerful person in the later Middle Kingdom, that power came from the king and only the king. The image of the king, presented throughout the kingdom in statues and portraits, shifted dramatically. Instead of a smiling, beautiful, idealized young man, the king was now presented realistically as a middle-aged man with living features, unsmiling, somewhat pessimistic in appearance. At the core of all this was some kind of significant change in religious beliefs. Even among the non-elite, long-standing traditions of burial and grave goods changed, and the religious texts copied into tombs showed different concerns, especially a much greater emphasis on the god Osiris. It went further than this, though. The biographical texts that elites had carved into their tombs had been around for a long time, going back into the Old Kingdom. But there were now way, way more examples of this kind of activity. The carving of steles, standing stones with text on them, became a widespread practice even outside the highest ranks of the elite. People wanted those who came after them to remember them, and the written word became the vehicle for that. Take this example. A city named Kusobek had a stela set up for him in a funerary temple in the city of Abydos. Why Abydos? Because that was the cult center for the god Osiris, and Kusobek wanted his spirit to participate in the god's rituals. The stela isn't exactly a masterpiece, in fact it's fairly crude, but it tells us quite a bit about Kusobek. It depicts him with six relatives, including his daughter and his brother, and says that he was born in the 27th year of the reign of King Amenemhat II, around 1893 BC. Kusobek fought against the Nubians in the south, and then fought for the king Senusret III in what is now Lebanon or Syria, gaining enough of a reputation for his deeds that Senusret personally rewarded him for his exploits. Stela like this were common, and we can clearly see the impulse that led the soldier Kusobek and others like him to have them carved and set up. Now, none of this is to say that life in the Middle Kingdom was perfect. It was not. Greater centralization and more royal building programs meant harsher labor demands on the populace, and runaways from these labor projects could be treated harshly. There's also good reason to think that people were forced to move within Egypt's borders to fill up newly created settlements and garrison fortresses on the frontiers. These fortresses, especially to the south in Nubia, are a reminder that Egypt's internal stability came at the price of violent foreign expeditions, like those Khus Sobek so proudly listed on the stela commemorating his life.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
The Middle Kingdom was a dynamic, lively, and above all, politically stable world that produced huge amounts of art, architecture, and monumental construction. When scholars talk about it as a golden age, and the Egyptians looked back at it as one of the classical periods of their history, this is what they're talking about. I think the literature in particular is worth a little bit more attention. That's because the Middle Kingdom was one of the first times in world history when literature, in the sense of written works of art, was produced in significant numbers. The royal courts of the 12th dynasty patronized poets who worked in writing. Their works spread out from the center to the provinces. Beyond poetry, there were a whole bunch of different genres. My favorite is a type of written text known as wisdom literature. And my favorite text of this type is called A Dispute Between a Man and His Ba, usually translated as A Debate Between a Man and His Soul. It's a fascinating text. The man and his soul argue about sorrow, the transitory nature of life, the benefits of the afterlife, and even suicide. Listen to this, one of the soul's statements to the man. Quote, "The gods who existed previously, who rest in their pyramids, the effective privileged likewise, who rest in their pyramids, their enclosures were built, but their places are no more. Their walls are lost and no more. Their places like that which has not come into being. Let your heart be informed about it, but let your heart forget about it. It is useful for you to follow your heart while you exist. You know that all things come to an end, the soul tells him, even the most eternal seeming things, but don't let the knowledge of that end prevent you from living a rich and full life now." I think that's a really beautiful sentiment. It's one of the things we can identify with even 4,000 years later. The author of A Debate Between a Man and His Soul knew that everything had to end eventually, and the Middle Kingdom was no exception. We saw early on that life in ancient Egypt existed on a spectrum from tight centralized control, exemplified by the building of the pyramids and the serious royal power of the later 12th dynasty, to total fragmentation. The first intermediate period had been the strongest example of that kind of internal breakup, but it was always a risk. And with the end of the 12th dynasty around 1760 BC, we can see the beginnings of a slide back along the spectrum toward decentralization and fragmentation. The beginning of the 13th dynasty was in effect the opposite of the 12th, with a whole bunch of short-lived kings occupying the throne in quick succession. It stabilized after a couple of decades, and a series of kings ruled much as their 12th dynasty predecessors had done, but the cracks were already showing. Sometime between about 1680 and 1650 BC, the rulers of the 13th dynasty moved their capital south to Thebes, where the Middle Kingdom had begun 4 centuries before. They had essentially lost control of the Nile Delta and Lower Egypt, and only Upper Egypt remained in their grasp, just as it had for the Theban kings of the first intermediate period. In their place, new dynasties of kings rose to power, taking control over various parts of this formerly unified kingdom. One of these new dynasties emerged in Lower Egypt, making their capital at the city of Avaris. These kings emerged not from the ranks of local governors or royal viziers, as past dynasties had, but from a group of recent migrants to the Nile Delta from further east. They belonged to a group the Egyptians called the Hyksos. So what happened? What caused this slip along the spectrum from unification to fragmentation? How did a group of foreigners manage to found a dynasty of rulers within the borders of Egypt itself? Something that had never, so far as we know, happened before. As with so many things in the history of ancient Egypt, we honestly aren't that sure. We have a firm sense for how this period, known as the Second Intermediate, began, with the foundation of a new Hyksos dynasty in Avaris, known as the 15th dynasty. We know how it ended more than a century later, with the conquest of Avaris by yet another dynasty of Theban kings moving north along the Nile to reunite Egypt once more and found the New Kingdom. Most everything else about this period, including the reason for the initial fragmentation, what happened in the middle, who ruled when and where and what they did while they ruled, even precisely how long the whole period lasted, all of that's unclear. The fact that the Avaris-based rulers of the 15th dynasty were foreigners, that's what Hyksos actually means, rulers of foreign lands, is generally considered to be the defining characteristic of the second intermediate period. That's the most common story anyway, and it comes from a source written down more than 1,000 years afterward by the Egyptian priest Manetho. Here's what Manetho says. Quote, "Unexpectedly from the regions of the east, invaders of obscure race marched in confidence of victory against our land. By main force, they easily seized it without striking a blow." So according to this version of events, Egypt was invaded, it was taken over by foreigners, and remained under foreign control until a native-born dynasty of kings expelled them in a glorious campaign of reconquest. So who were the Hyksos? Where had they come from? And were they actually invaders? Recent work, including extensive excavations at Avaris, known by the modern name of Tel el Daba, has shed a ton of light on these questions. We know a lot more about the Hyksos and their rule over Egypt now than we did a few decades ago, and it's a lot more interesting than a straightforward story of conquest. This new evidence points toward a much more gradual process of migration from the Levant in the northeast, today's Palestine and Lebanon, maybe even Syria, rather than a violent overnight invasion. At Tel el Daba, the site of the future Hyksos capital in the Nile Delta, excavations have found signs of the presence of Easterners dating all the way back to the 11th dynasty in the first intermediate period, or the very beginning of the Middle Kingdom. That's centuries before the start of the second intermediate. Over the course of the Middle Kingdom, these signs of connection between the Levant and Lower Egypt got stronger. The pottery found in layers from this period increasingly came from the Levant, or was based on Levantine models, especially those found at the city of Byblos in Lebanon. The houses at Tel el Daba showcased a mixture of Levantine and Egyptian features. Whether we're talking about migrants or ethnic foreigners influenced by Egyptian customs, Egyptians influenced by Levantine ways of doing things, some combination of the two is hard to tell, but the fact of it is clear. By the time the 13th dynasty and the Middle Kingdom as a whole came to an end, the elite group controlling Tel el Daba looked like migrants from the northern Levant. They were buried with weapons and funerary offering pits identical with those of the northern Levant. They built temples that looked like they belonged in Lebanon. Their religious practices, which featured ritual sacrifices of donkeys and pigs, were essentially identical with those of the northern Levant. Evidence of trade with the Levant grew even stronger, and the site became increasingly prosperous. This is exactly what we would expect if Tel el Daba was the capital of a new dynasty of rulers. The Egyptologist Anna Latifa Murad, who has written the most recent and comprehensive work on the Hyksos and their origins, sums up the sequence of events like this. At first, Tel el Daba was a trading site, a prosperous one, inhabited by a mixture of foreigners from the Levant and Egyptians. Officials, subject to the central administration of the Middle Kingdom pharaohs, controlled the city, though the officials themselves may have been immigrants from the Levant or descendants of immigrants. The city grew ever larger and more prosperous. It was probably swelled by new migrants from what's now Lebanon, and at some point in the second half of the 13th dynasty, a noticeable change took place. Political power within the city seemed to shift to a new elite that embraced foreign religious rituals. This new elite, to put two and two together, was almost certainly the new rulers of the quote-unquote Hyksos 15th dynasty. For the rest of this period, Tel el Daba grew in size and wealth. We can see evidence for trading connections with places as distant as Cyprus in the north and Nubia in the south. Once established in Tel el Daba, new settlements showing elements of this hybridized culture showed up throughout the Nile Delta, presumably founded by a mixture of new migrants and the powerful elite of Tel el Daba. This was a cosmopolitan elite. They even imported specialist craftsmen from Minoan Crete to paint stunning frescoes for them. Some of them, presumably the more recent arrivals, had noticeably foreign names, derived from Semitic languages, but others had Egyptian names. This isn't surprising. Their ancestors had presumably lived in Tel el Daba for more than a century. They had intermarried with Egyptians. They had taken on aspects of Egyptian culture. They spoke the Egyptian language, and so on. So rather than thinking of the Hyksos as invading foreigners, we should see them as a distinct group in an Egyptian world that was actually much more diverse than we might expect. And of course, some of these Hyksos elites were kings. Not foreign kings, but Egyptian kings. They had Egyptian names, titles, and displays of royal ideology that were essentially identical with their predecessors in the Middle Kingdom. Again, rather than invaders, we should see them as the product of a centuries-long engagement between the maritime trading cities of the Levant and Egypt, with some contact coming through the desert as well. As kings, these new elites fought against their rivals, the rulers of dynasties based in Upper Egypt to the south. The more famous of these dynastic rivals were based in Thebes, the 16th and then 17th dynasties, but recent work has discovered another, simultaneous and previously unknown line of kings that was based in the city of Abydos at the same time. As a side note, the fact that we can still discover a whole new line of kings should tell us just how shadowy this period really is and how much we still have to learn about it. Anyways, kings fought kings just as they had done in the first intermediate period. The fact that the eventual winners felt the need to cast their defeated foes as foreigners tells us a lot more about them than their Hyksos rivals, I think. We shouldn't cast this as the inevitable overthrow of foreign rule and the restoration of righteous Egyptian control over their country. The Hyksos kings weren't that much different from those of the Middle Kingdom. If they'd won, later writers could easily have minimized their foreign origins and connections in order to emphasize their Egyptianness and the continuity with the past of the Middle and the Old Kingdoms. They weren't destined to lose either. In fact, they inflicted serious defeats on their rivals to the south. The 17th dynasty pharaoh Sekenenretau, whom we met back at the very beginning of this episode, well, didn't exactly meet him, is generally credited with beginning the reconquest. His sons, first Kamosa and then Amosa I, founder of the 18th dynasty, finished the reconquest. The reason it wasn't Sekenenretau who finished off the Hyksos is because they killed him. The mummy of Sekenenretau was discovered, along with those of a number of later rulers of the 18th and 19th dynasties, back in the 1880s. The body was hastily and poorly embalmed. The brain hadn't been removed, no linen had been placed in the eyes or cranium, and the normally careful use of natron salts to absorb moisture from the corpse hadn't taken place. Sekenenretau's mummy is the worst preserved of all the royal mummies known to date for precisely that reason. But despite the body's poor preservation, the damage done to it before and at the time of death is shocking and obvious. A massive gaping hole splits his forehead horizontally, just over a second, slightly smaller fracture above his right eyebrow. His nose, right eye socket, and cheekbone were smashed. His left ear features a smaller puncture wound, and several other stab wounds stud the right side of his skull. According to a recent study based on intensive CT scanning carried out by Sahar Salim and Zahi Hawass, Sekenenre receiving at least two or three of those injuries would have been immediately fatal. The rest of his body is in poor shape, but the hands are intact enough to show severe trauma. Those weren't parry wounds of the type a desperate person often receives when they're trying to defend themselves. Instead, the hand injuries were most likely caused by an intense contraction at the moment of death called a cadaveric spasm. That could only have happened if his hands were tied, probably behind his back, when he was killed. Moreover, the shapes of the wounds closely match bronze weapons excavated at Tel El Daba, weapons of types common in the Bronze Age of the Levant. In other words, Hyksos weapons. The most likely scenario here is that Sekenenre was captured in a battle with the Hyksos, maybe after that brutal blunt force trauma, probably from an axe handle, had smashed his nose, eye socket, and cheekbone, had left him incapacitated. His hands were then tied behind him, and he was forced to kneel. Surrounded by his attackers, they executed him on the battlefield, smashing his forehead with axes, piercing his ear with a spear, and then administering a frenzied coup de grace with a dagger to be sure he was dead. They left his body on the ground, lying on his left side. His corpse stayed in that position, on the left side, for long enough that it started to decompose. We can tell because his brain started to dry out and shifted toward that side of his skull before the body was recovered and transported back to Thebes for mummification. No matter how skilled the arts of mummification had become by the 17th dynasty, they could only do so much for Sekenenretau. When his mummy was unwrapped in the 1880s, the Egyptologist carrying out the procedure noted the horrendous smell of decomposition that the mummy still retained after more than 3,500 years. Second Enrique Tao launched his campaign of reconquest against the Hyksos kings ruling from Avaris, but he paid with his life. He had no way of knowing that his sons would finish what he started, that the 15th dynasty of Hyksos kings would be destined to become a footnote in Egyptian history, and that another classical age, the New Kingdom, would follow. We shouldn't take that for granted. When we think of ancient Egypt as an unchanging monolith, an eternal given in the grand scheme of human history, we erase the complicated lives and deaths even of the people at the very pinnacle of society, people like Seken Enri Tau. The Hyksos kings weren't destined to be thought of as foreign invaders. The ruler with whom Seken Enri Tau quarreled, known to posterity as Apepi, also had the very Egyptian throne name Nebkepshepre, meaning Re is the Lord of Strength. Had Seken Enri Tau's sons not been as capable as they were, would posterity have remembered his enemies as foreigners at all? Egypt wasn't destined to be reunited under the rule of the New Kingdom pharaohs. Chaos, as the Egyptians knew so well, was always lurking just out of the reach of the forces of order. It took a great deal of work, both the work of remembering and the work of forgetting, to maintain that facade of Egypt's continuity over so many thousands of years. Next time on Tides of History, we're going to talk more about the people living beyond Egypt's borders, especially to the south. People had inhabited the lands of Nubia for many thousands of years by the time the first king began to rule in Upper Egypt, and they created a whole series of vibrant and fascinating cultures that lasted for thousands of years more. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. I've also written a book called The Verge: Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. It's available now on hard copy, ebook, or audiobook that I read, of course, from your distributor of choice. There's a link in this episode description that will take you there. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. Sound designed by Molly Bach for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Jenny Lower-Beckman and Marshall Louie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just three simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.